Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a military analyst who's just returned from Afghanistan. But first, a Marine who may be headed there. We start today closer to home. In fact, literally in the backyard.
Lay down a couple of schools, please.
The folks who live on Carlton Street in Newton, Massachusetts, gathered for a cookout recently to say goodbye to a neighbor, Brandon Baya.
I'm 19, and I'll be 20 in October, so right before we go.
He's expected to go to Afghanistan, where at least 49 Americans have been killed since a new offensive was launched in July. This past Saturday, Marine Private Brandon Baya was home on leave, probably the last time he'd see his family, friends, and neighbors before his expected deployment. Full disclosure, our colleague Steph Katsonis is one of Brandon's neighbors and was part of the send-off. And Here Now's Alex Ashlock decided to go as well.
If you want to try anything, there's calzone right now. There's quesadillas. Raphael's making chicken. We made some calzones.
That's Brandon's mother, Cheryl Martinez, with the cookout menu. She says her son was already acting like a Marine when he was 8 years old, peppering the side of their house with his BB gun. You can still see the holes.
Yeah, he's always liked guns and fighting and doing stuff like that, but he's got the attitude of a Marine.
And he sure looks the part. Brush-cut hair, muscles, tone from months of training in the desert in California, tattoos etched on his arms. He pulls up his shirt to display a fresh one.
Oh, I got all these before. I just got a new one yesterday just because I love them. It's, you know, something that I probably shouldn't be spending money on when I got other things to worry about, but I like it, so.
How do you feel about all these folks showing up to?
I appreciate it. You know, it shows me that, you know, there's a lot of people that care about me and what people like me do.
Do you have apprehensions about going to Afghanistan if that's where you end up going?
No, I mean, I'm excited, to be honest. I just kind of want to get the hell out of garrison and, you know, go, you know, do what I enlisted to do.
How's the calzone?
Wasn't bad.
That's Bob Baya, Brandon's father, with a less-than-ringing endorsement of Cheryl's calzone. He says there's a long tradition of military service in the Baya family, although he didn't follow it.
The only reason I never joined the military is I refused to cut my hair.
So you're proud of him?
Very. Extremely.
Are you apprehensive at all about him going to Afghanistan?
My brother was in Desert Storm.
What do you think about all these folks coming over to sort of see him off?
Not a surprise at all. He's well-loved.
I've known him since, what, freshman year?
And the small backyard was crammed with Brandon's family and friends, including Erica Acapinti, one of his high school classmates.
I mean, you know, we're proud of him, obviously. He seems to love it, so, you know. Obviously, there's a little bit of worry, of course, you know, but he wants to do it. He loves it, so we're proud.
Guys, is the guy allowed to make a speech? Is anybody allowed to make a speech here?
No?
Neighbor Steph Katsonis presented Brandon with an engraved leather man. That's one of those small multi-purpose tools. It was a gift from his neighbors on Carlton Street. Brandon said it will come in handy wherever he's deployed because his old one is broken.
You know what's ironic? This is the same exact one I have, the charge.
Really? Yeah. The charge, really?
Yeah. I got both of my knives are broken, and so is my pliers.
Really? So this is from your Carlton Street family? What can I say? You're going to come back. You're going to walk through that looking glass. You're going to come back like with a million stories to tell and a million people asking you to tell stories. So save them up and come back safe.
I already got plenty of stories. I haven't even been anywhere yet.
We want him back safe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That report from Here Now's Alex Ashlock. Well, what is the U.S. strategy in the country where Brandon Baya is most likely headed? One diplomat has described President Obama's strategy as winning hearts, minds, and stomachs. But in ordering more than 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan, Obama has said the goal is to defeat al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And last month, More U.S. soldiers were killed than in any month so far in the eight-year war there. The new commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, was supposed to complete an overall assessment of the war by mid-August that McChrystal said would include whether he'd need additional troops, but that deadline is being extended, and the Pentagon now says the report won't make any recommendations on troop levels, even though advisors have told McChrystal he's going to need more. Well, our next guest goes back to our original question. What will troops do once there? And if they are dying in battles, why aren't we hearing more about those battles than winning hearts and minds? Bing West is a writer and former Assistant Secretary for Defense. He's also a former combat Marine who reports regularly from Iraq and Afghanistan. Bing, we understand you just got back from a trip to Afghanistan.
Yes, that was my fourth trip to Afghanistan.
And you were embedded living with troops. In fact, let's start there. Because your trip became intensely personal, you were with several different units around the country. I understand one soldier in the cot right next to you was killed 2 weeks ago?
Yes, Sergeant Eric Lindstrom. He was a wonderful young man, the best squad leader in the platoon, and he left behind his wife and two youngsters, 7 months old, two twin girls.
What happened?
He was hit by an RPG, and there was nothing that anyone could do to revive him. It was in a very remote valley, way up at the top of Afghanistan. The people up there weren't regular Taliban. They were just kind of Al-Qaeda recruited from somewhere in Pakistan, and they attacked across the border. I mean, it was just a bizarre thing, absolutely bizarre. It's like you're fighting tribes that are back in the first century.
So this missile, not from an organized unit at all, but some sounds like stragglers.
Well, none of them are organized the way we think they're organized. It's more equivalent to fighting the Apaches in the 1870s. You get these different gangs, and they're very good fighters. They use the mountains very, very well, and they were shooting down. They had what we call plunging fire. And we're firing rocket-propelled grenades, and unfortunately, one of them struck and killed Sergeant Lindstrom.
Well, a terrible loss, as any life is. But I just have to pick up, you mentioned the Apaches. The difference would seem to be that you write that the Taliban in modern day has very little popular support.
Well, I doubt if the Apaches had too much support either.
Well, but they had fellow Apaches.
That's about what the Taliban have. The dilemma you have now in Afghanistan is that most of the people there just want to be left alone. But when the Taliban come in at night, there's no one there to ward them off. So while they like the Americans, I mean, they really like the fact that we're the ones building the schools and hospitals and the roads, the idea that they're going to stand up to the Taliban, that hasn't happened because they keep saying, you know, holy smokes, when you're not here, they come right in. So the Taliban are looked at by most Afghans as being a bunch of wackos, but they're very, very fierce fighters, and they come back and forth across that Pakistani border just like they're driving down the road.
And we're reminded of a recent article in the Sunday New York Times where Marines observed how much more tenacious the Taliban are than insurgents in Iraq.
They stay in the fight with you. I was with those Marines down in Helmand who were mentioned in the article. And they'll stay about one tree line away from you across an open field, and they'll shoot at you, and then you bound forward, and they run back. And you can continue that kind of fighting for a long, long time. The morale of the Taliban has not been broken. They're still willing to stay out on that field and fight with you.
Well, now, this observation, coupled with Staff Sergeant Lindstrom's death, underscore something else you say about how the military is presenting the war in Afghanistan. We're not hearing about these battles.
I'm a little bit miffed at our senior commanders for spending so much time saying that we have to sit down and have cups of tea with the village elders and that the war is not kinetic, meaning it's not shooting. Well, if they believe that, why are they sending over all our soldiers with rifles? The fact is, it is a shooting war. And every time they say, well, this has to be solved by political means, that strikes me as being like the chief of police who says, well, you can't blame me for crime because crime comes from society as a whole. And I think that our senior generals should spend more time focused on the battles and less time talking about cups of tea.
Well, but you say this, even as if that kind of thinking seems to be taking hold even more. We understand that General Stanley McChrystal, who took over the command of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan in June, is preparing a new strategy. It sounds as if what has been talked about for years is indeed going to be pushed even more. We're hearing that this thinking is to switch from tracking insurgents to the primary mission, protecting civilians.
That's like saying you have the mafia in town, but you're not going to focus on the mafia. You're going to focus on protecting the civilians. I don't understand it, and I've been on a lot of battlefields throughout my entire life, starting with a combined action platoon in Vietnam for 2 years. I just don't understand this talk about protecting the people without fighting the enemy. It baffles me. It's double talk as far as I'm concerned.
Well, some of your recommendations are in line with what we're hearing General McChrystal is also asking for. You say what's needed, more troops, U.S. and Afghan, more helicopters. Let the Afghans do the work. What do you mean by that?
I mean it's their country. The Taliban are their primary enemy. And I want to see more of the Afghans out there. We just sent 10,000 Marines into Helmand Province, and there were only 500 Afghan soldiers when we got there. So I think our military bureaucracy has done a terrible job, an absolutely terrible job, of building up the Afghan soldiers, because the Afghans will fight. But we have been spending years. We're 9 years into this war, and we're just building an army now. I mean, I don't get it. We've made some very bad military mistakes, and trying to cover that up by saying, well, it's because we haven't drunk enough cups of tea strikes me as being a cop-out.
But where's the disconnect? We're hearing from people like former British diplomat Rory Stewart that you have to drink tea first.
Well, whatever mechanism gets them there, do it. I agree with Rory entirely. I mean, he'd like to see many more Afghans out there and many fewer Europeans and Americans. I believe that after this surge is over, say a year from now, it's time to have many more Afghans out in front to fight their own fight.
So it's sort of like you're saying you agree there should be this interaction with Afghans, but not as much to sit and have tea as to get them to get out and defend their own country.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Right. But the questions have been raised, can we afford to build the Afghan army? Are you saying we can't afford not to?
This is a huge problem with our Congress. Our Congress has been terrific toward our soldiers. But the minute you say to the U.S. Congress, now I need $4 to $8 billion a year for the next 5 to 10 years for the Afghans, not for us, then the U.S. Congress says, well, wait a minute, we have so many problems ourselves. Why can't the Europeans or somebody else put up that money? So that is a huge problem, Robin.
That's Bing West, former Assistant Secretary for Defense, Combat Marine. He reports regularly from Iraq and has just returned from one of several trips to Afghanistan. Bing, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And before we take a break, this note. They called them Tommies, the British World War I troops who fought in the trenches. And today they say goodbye to the last one. Harry Patch died July 25th at the age of 111. The group Radiohead released this song in commemoration. It's called Last Tommy. Profits will go to the British Legion Veterans Organization. We'll be back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. This week, the Secretary of Transportation announced a distracted driving summit as some lawmakers push for withholding federal funds from states that don't ban text messaging while driving, and as studies pile up. Consider this. If you're driving 70 miles an hour, it takes about half a second to brake. That's less than a foot of highway space. But if you're legally drunk, it takes about 5 feet of road. If you're reading an email, it takes 36 feet. And if you're sending a text message, you add 70 feet to that. That's according to Car and Driver magazine. And studies like that are adding to the call for government action. The Transportation Department summit is slated for September. Secretary Ray LaHood likening the lack of uniform regulation on cell phones and BlackBerries to the days before seatbelt and drunk driving laws. Clarence Ditlow is executive director of the Center for Auto Safety. That's in Washington. And Clarence, how big a problem do you think distracted driving is?
It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, problem on the road today. Over 20% of crashes are caused by distracted driving, and 18% of those, it's the sole cause of the accident.
Well, we understand it was a New York Times report that showed that the risk of a crash rose 23% when drivers were texting. How do you define distracted driving?
Distracted driving is when either your eyes or mind are not on the road, and as a result, you're much more likely to have a crash.
Would you include just using your cell phone to talk on your cell phone?
No doubt about it.
Huh.
Just using a cell phone takes your mind off the road. And if your mind is off the road just for a couple of seconds, you can go several hundred feet down that road. And if there's an object there, if there's a line of traffic, if there's a red light, you go right through it and a crash will occur.
Well, there was a case last year where a woman died applying nail polish while driving. We regularly see people eating, applying makeup, shaving. So would you say anything that isn't both hands on the wheel, only driving and not doing anything else would be distracted driving?
Yes, it would be.
Yeah. What kind of laws would you like to see?
Our first priority is to simply ban texting and driving because it's six times as bad as drinking and driving to be texting and driving.
And what states have already banned texting and driving?
There are about 13 states that have done it. They range from California to the District of Columbia. But we want to have every single state ban it.
And what's your evidence that laws for distracted driving would work?
All one has to do is look at what has happened with drunk driving. The incidence of drunk driving has gone down as we've passed more and more stringent drunk driving laws and as we've enforced those laws.
Others point to the seatbelt laws. Seatbelt usage was at 20% before laws. Now it's at 80 to 90%, and there's direct evidence that deaths from accidents have gone down as a result. But you mentioned drunk driving. What do you say to people who say new legislation would just be piling up regulation? Meanwhile, they don't think drunk driving legislation works that well, especially since the horrible story of a New York mother allegedly driving drunk and high and the wrong way on the Taconic Parkway, killing 8 people, including her children and nieces and 3 strangers. Their families talking about suing the family of the drivers, saying family members who even know someone has a drinking problem should be held responsible. But back to the question, you know, there are people who say laws don't work.
Well, laws do work, but laws are not perfect. If we can get the incidence of alcohol involvement down to 1%, that person who will drink and drive, who will be high and drive, like the woman on Taconic Parkway.
Allegedly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What we need to do is to recognize that we can get the incident rate down from 50% or 60%, which it once was, to 40 to 30, and move it constantly downward until there's only a hard core, but that hard core is going to be the exception.
So who would you like to see at the table at this distracted drivers conference slated for September?
Well, we would like to see safety advocates. We'd like to see the cell phone industry there. We'd like to see a whole range of leaders in the area of highway safety. We certainly want state legislators there. We want the police officers there who are going to enforce the laws. And we want the advocacy groups that are going to help pass them.
Well, the Cell Phone Trade Industry Association president recently said that his industry supports all state and local statutes, including those that ban texting while driving. But he says the bigger thing to do is educate people, not pass laws.
We need both. We need education and we need laws. The cell phone industry in the early days actually opposed the laws, and we have fewer laws today than what we would if they had supported them in the past.
Well, and back to who else might be responsible here, as we hear the survivors of those killed in that terrible drunk driving crash are thinking of suing the family of the driver. Should family members be responsible, let's say, for people who text and drive and cause accidents?
We would certainly go after the individuals who are texting. We believe that just as you can sue a bartender who serves you too many drinks, knowing that you're likely to be involved in a crash, you can sue the cell phone provider. And there have been those lawsuits already.
And how have they fared?
They have settled, and they've lost some of the lawsuits. There's already a judgment of a settlement of $2 million against one cell phone provider where talking on that cell phone caused the crash.
So I would think the cell phone industry might want to get involved in keeping people from doing that.
They should. I mean, if you look at the alcohol industry says drink responsibly. The cell phone industry today is saying talk responsibly. Well, we want regulations that require that. And we don't want people driving down that highway with their eyes off the road or their mind off the road for 300 feet talking or texting on their cell phone.
That's Clarence Ditlow, Executive Director of the Center for Auto Safety, the nonprofit advocacy group in Washington, D.C. Clarence, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, reinvention is the theme for a black journalist meeting in Florida, but can they revive struggling black newspapers and magazines? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Nissan's new electric car. After the latest news, Here and Now. More beautiful women. That's the headline for a number of studies arguing that evolution is still at work and it's producing more and more beautiful women. A new Finnish study claims that beautiful women have more children than their plainer counterparts. And previous studies showed that attractive people are more likely to have girls. Girls who are also beautiful and, as we just said, the Finnish study says, then have more children. So some scientists are concluding women are getting more beautiful. Evolutionary biologist Satoshi Kanazawa is co-author of Why Beautiful People Have More Daughters. He teaches at the London School of Economics and writes the blog The Scientific Fundamentalist for the magazine Psychology Today. He joins us from his home outside London. So, Professor Kanazawa, why do beautiful people have more daughters?
Well, the basic principle is this. Whenever parents have some traits that they can pass on to their children that are better for sons than for daughters, then they're more likely to have sons. Conversely, whenever parents have some traits that they can pass on to their children that are better for girls than for boys, then they're more likely to have daughters. And being physically attractive is good for both sons and daughters, but it's slightly better for girls to be good-looking than for boys.
Well, and yes, culturally it probably still is more advantageous for girls to be attractive. But you're saying that we can actually control which genetic traits we pass on and somehow choose which gender?
Well, we may not be able to control which traits we pass on, but the human bodies, the mothers and fathers, do control the sex of the offspring. It's been known for a long time that certain traits the parents have influence the sex of the offspring.
Well, this is fascinating. What about as we change culturally? For instance, girls are often just as athletic as boys. So does that change the evolution now? Might parents who are very athletic now maybe have more girls because girls can be athletic as well as boys?
Well, from an evolutionary psychological perspective, how things are now doesn't matter as much as how things used to be more than 10,000 years ago during the period when our ancestors evolved. So the fact that girls can do anything boys can do now doesn't matter because that wasn't the way it was more than 10,000 years ago. So it was always men who hunted and who got into physical contest. So as a result, even today, bigger and taller parents are more likely to have sons because it was advantageous for boys to be bigger and taller.
And it was more advantageous for women to be physically attractive to attract mates?
It has always been the case, and it still is the case, because physical attractiveness is an indicator of health. So physically attractive women are actually genetically and developmentally healthier.
I'm sure you've had people attempt to debate this with you. For instance, how do you rate beauty? Some would say, isn't beauty in the eye of the beholder?
That's one of the greatest misconceptions that people have, that evolution psychology has dispelled, beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. It is not only skin deep. Beauty, as I said, is an indicator of underlying genetic and developmental health, and it shows in the face and in the body as bilateral symmetry. So beautiful faces are symmetrical faces, and also beautiful faces are average faces. So beauty can be reduced to geometric and mathematical and biological factors, and now there's a computer program that can precisely measure somebody's physical attractiveness, like we can measure height and weight.
So you're saying that even though humans have evolved to a sort of self-awareness and consciousness that puts us beyond the, you know, you hunt, I be pretty and attract you, even though we're beyond that culturally, our genes are not.
First of all, we're not sure if we are beyond that culturally, but even if we are, yes, it takes a long time for human genes to evolve. So our brain is pretty much stuck the way it was 10,000 years ago.
It's thought-provoking, Professor. It's also a real put-down for men. I mean, essentially, this science is saying guys really haven't evolved a lot when it comes to looks.
No, that's not true. In terms of physical attractiveness, probably, because more attractive parents are slightly more likely to have daughters, the average level of physical attractiveness has been going up among women more than among men, but by the same token, men have been getting taller because taller parents are more likely to have sons. So women are getting more beautiful and men are getting taller, among other things.
Fascinating. Evolutionary biologist Satoshi Kanazawa, who teaches at the London School of Economics, writes the blog The Scientific Fundamentalist for the magazine Psychology Today, and also is co-author of Why Beautiful People Have More Daughters. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And I'm so sorry if you're one of those who hasn't gotten taller either. We'll be back after a quick break, here and now. The Senate is poised today to add $2 billion to the popular Cash for Clunkers program and give shoppers until Labor Day to get rebates of up to $4,500 for their gas guzzlers if that money is then spent on cars with better mileage. Car companies have credited the program with driving up sales in late July as consumers do buy smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. Well, there may be a new ultra-efficient option for car buyers in the very near future. This week, the Japanese automaker Nissan unveiled its long-awaited electric car, the Leaf. It's a five-door midsize hatchback with a 100-mile cruising range and a top speed of 90 miles an hour. Jim Montevalli is a contributor to the New York Times Wheels blog. He's also author of Forward Drive, The Race to Build Clean Cars for the Future. He's at the studios of WHSU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Jim, Nissan calls its Leaf the world's first affordable zero-emissions car. Truth in advertising?
Well, they are saying it's going to be affordable, but they're not saying what it will actually cost. They're saying it would be about the same as a mid-sized car comparably equipped, which probably means $20,000 to $25,000, which would be extremely cheap. In particular, if you think that the battery costs $10,000 on its own, it's quite likely they'll lose a little bit of money on these. I think one of the big drawbacks is the 100-mile range. Consumers have to adjust to that, and it may take some doing for that.
Well, in that case, is the Leaf automatically maybe a second car or a car, an urban car, or for people who run errands, if you have to plug it in and recharge it every 100 miles or so? And by the way, how long will it take to recharge?
Well, I think that it's a psychological barrier. Most people really only travel about 70 miles on average in a day. So in terms of their real-world use of the car, it probably won't be that big an obstacle. But psychologically, they're used to cars that travel 300 miles. So it's quite an adjustment. It's like having a car that's always on quarter tank or less. The charging will take probably, for most people, about 8 hours. That's on a 220-volt charger that most people will, if they have this car, they'll probably have that in their house. If you plug it just in a 110 outlet, it's going to take 14 hours. On the other hand, you could do fast charging, and that takes like 26 minutes, but that's not something you're going to have in your house. That's more like big box stores, I think, will be equipped with that. Like your Walmart's going to have fast charging.
They're saying that they're going to do that for recreational vehicles as well. And we're seeing around here in the Boston area, some hotels have charging stations in their parking lots getting ready for the future. And the future, according to Nissan, is coming fast. They say they're going to have this car, as we said, out in 2010. That's about the same time the newly reorganized General Motors is going to roll out its Volt. What do you think of the competition there?
Well, they're kind of in different categories. The Volt is a range extender electric vehicle, and it's going to have a lot of range, so it won't have the range problem. On the other hand, it's going to be about $40,000, so it could be double the price of the Leaf. And if that's the case, then that's kind of a barrier. I do think the biggest obstacle to people buying the Volt is the high cost of it. The smart thing about Nissan is they also have partnerships to build the charging stations. And initially, they're only going to sell the car in the markets where they have those charging infrastructures in place. So I think that if you have one of these cars, if you buy one, you're going to be able to charge it, which really solves the whole chicken and egg problem for EVs.
We in Nissan developing partnerships to build these charging stations in Seattle, Oregon, Tennessee, San Diego, San Francisco, Phoenix, Tucson, Raleigh, Washington, D.C., just some of the hubs that they may have. Just a quick question. What about environmental concerns? Critics say charging a car, of course, takes electricity, which takes, it's going to take either coal or nuclear right now.
Right. It really depends on where you're charging. If you're charging in California, that's a pretty clean grid. Here in New England, where I live, it's kind of a mixed bag. In the Midwest, you're talking almost exclusively coal plants, so that's pretty dirty. Still, even with that, if you're charging from 100% dirty coal energy, I still think that a battery electric is going to be a lot cleaner in overall lifetime emissions than a gas car.
And do you think this is fait accompli? I'm reading some estimates that electric plug-in cars will be the car we drive by 2030.
I think that's probably accurate. The combined effects of climate change and peak oil really make this an imperative pretty quickly.
And finally, Jim, the new Nissan car, they're calling it the Leaf. You had some thoughts on that.
Well, my daughter said to me that she didn't consider that a very manly name. She's 12, and I hadn't thought about that at all.
It's no Mustang.
You know, out of the mouth of babes.
Right.
No, it's not like Mustang or Magnum or Nitro or Hemi or one of those real macho names. You know, you think of a Leaf being blown around in the wind, and, you know, it sounds a little flimsy maybe.
Well, but, you know, this is where the feminine side of you might come in and say, but it feels green.
Well, they like Leaf because, you know, the leaves clean the air and they take carbon dioxide out. And I'm sure they're going to have a green Leaf logo and everything. And actually, the car's logo is blue. And the guy from Nissan told me that blue is the new green.
Jim Motovalli, contributor to the New York Times Wheels blog, also author of Forward Drive, The Race to Build Clean Cars for the Future. Jim, with an assist from his daughter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So I went to see Paul last night. It's probably more accurate to say I was dragged, eyes rolling, to see Paul McCartney at Fenway Park here in Boston, which is weird because they were my tickets. As I told my guests, it's just that my earliest memories are of the Beatles at Shea Stadium. I was at the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm not into that whole Wings thing. What can I possibly learn from Paul McCartney today? What was I thinking?
Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star.
The music was largely from the Beatles, but also Wings and his new project, The Fireman. There were homages to John and George and Linda, a peek at the new Beatles video game, and a night-long conversation. At one point, Paul marveling at how Sgt. Pepper came out on a Friday, and by Sunday, Jimi Hendrix had learned it for his concert. There were little kids everywhere, riding on their parents' backs, absorbing almost 50 years of rock and roll. As the Boston Globe writes, Paul was vital and relevant. The Herald adds, bloody brilliant. My favorite moment, Blackbird.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life.
He explained he'd written it in the 60s when there was some trouble in the American South. He envisioned a little black girl. Well, the little black girl, now fully grown, standing next to me, was shocked. Beverly and I turned to each other and said simultaneously, who knew? Maybe we did know once and forgot, but at that moment, he seemed to be singing right to her, and I was thinking, I could still learn a thing or two from Paul McCartney.
On your line, you were only waiting for this moment to be free.
Thanks to New England Cable News for driving my car. Blackbird is from a 2002 concert. It's even better today. Back in a minute, here and now.
To the light of a dark black night.
Welcome back. One Saturday night, while listening to Con Salsa, that's a Latin music show hosted by our friend Jose Maso here at the Mothership, WBUR in Boston, I heard, could it be on Con Salsa, Danny Boy? It's I picked up the phone and asked Jose, who is this? It's Luba Mason, he said. Ah, Luba Mason, the tall, blonde singer of Slovakian descent. Yes. But what's with the Latin percussion? Oh, that's Ruben Blades, her husband. To find out more about this musical marriage, we've invited Luba Mason and her husband, singer, songwriter, actor, politician, Ruben Blades, to our studios, and they've been kind enough to take a break from the tour they're on to promote Luba's new CD, Crazy Love, Crazy with a K. And Luba, Ruben, welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Hi, how are you? And thank you very much for having us.
Well, that really did happen. It was a sit up straight in bed. What is that moment? And as you know, Ruben, Luba is an accomplished actress, a dancer with roles in Law and Order, NYPD Blue, on Broadway, Chicago with Brooke Shields, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying with Matthew Broderick. But when did your world intersect with hers?
We were doing together the Paul Simon musical, The Cape Man. Mm-hmm. That's where we met.
You had the lead in that.
I think it was 98, 99.
You know, I'm kind of embarrassed to say I didn't even know he was a musician when I met him.
You thought he was an actor?
I knew him as an actor. And
Milagro, Beanfield War and others?
Yes, yeah. And all of a sudden I hear him singing in this show, like thinking, oh, wow, this actor really sings pretty good. And the next thing I know, he's got like 100 Grammys and, you know, he's, you know, done a million albums. And it's been quite an education, actually, being with Ruben musically.
Well, because also Latin music, Brazilian music, I mean, this was not music you were familiar with.
Not part of my vocabulary at all. He totally opened my world up to Latin music.
Well, on your new CD, with Ruben Blades making several appearances, and by the way, one reviewer wrote something like, not since Masters and Johnson has music been this sexy, something like that. This worked out well. Let's listen to one Brazilian duet. It's called, I'm going to try this, E Como Esse Que Eu Vou?
E Como Esse Que Eu Vou, written by Pedro Caetano. It's one of two covers on the album.
And translated from the Portuguese, what is that?
And It Is With You That I Go. It's a duet with Ruben.
Ruben singing in Portuguese, you in English, Luba. Let's listen.
I would like to hear the cuica bring together people rich and poor forever to create.
Quebra, quebra, que eu quero ver uma cabrocha boa no piano da patroa. Bate o cano e com ela que eu vou.
Quebra, quebra,
eu quero ver uma cabrocha boa.
Ruben, you were born in Panama, grew up with music. Had you ever sung in Portuguese, by the way?
No. But I began to listen to Portuguese music at a very early age. So I grew up with that.
But I'm understanding that when people hear this music on the new CD, or at least these softer songs, they ask you, Luba, who's that? Because
all the time. Yeah, because first of all, you can't really recognize his voice. He's singing very differently. And the fact that he's singing in Portuguese, I think, kind of throws people off as well.
Well, let's remind people just a little bit of Ruben Blades, one of his recordings. You know, singing salsa, cutting through all that brass. Let's
yes.
listen.
Y Pedro Navaja cayó en la acera mientras veía a esa mujer que revolver en mano y de muerte herida. Ay, le decía, yo que pensaba, hoy no es mi día, estoy sala. Pero Pedro Navaja, tú estás peor, no estás en nada.
That's Pedro Navaja, Ruben Blades' Latin take on Mac the Knife. Ruben now performing with his wife, Luba Mason, Cape Man, again where they met. And Cape Man, we understand, a turning point for you, Luba, in that you discovered that Ruben Blades sings.
Well, aside from that.
Aside from that, also, you had studied classical music.
Yes, I started as a classical pianist for 12 years, and then I studied classical voice. I have an older sister who was an opera singer. And I had a career in Broadway for about 15 years, did about 8 or 9 Broadway shows. And then when Cape Man came around, the world of Latin music was introduced to me. And just kind of all these elements in a medium like Broadway that I made my roots in, and it just all kind of came together and blew my mind all at the same time. So,
well, here's some more of the result. Another track on the CD. This one is called Summer Night. Let's listen.
Spring.
Luba has spoken of what meeting you did for her blew open the doors to this new world of Latin music. What about you and her? I'm looking at, it's radio, so I'm sorry, Luba, I have to say, a stunning blonde, as we said, of Slovakian descent,
so
with a Broadway and classical Western music background. What did it do for you?
Well, my first impression was the talent that was there. I mean, that was a very obvious from the beginning. The fact that she can play the piano, you know, also I found attractive because my mother used to play piano and sing.
I guess I'm also asking, do we see Ruben Blades sit down at the piano anytime soon and play Chopin? I mean, is there going to be a little rubbing off on you of her musical background?
You know, we joke about I have this great picture of Ruben sitting at the piano in some opera house like he is, you know, Horowitz or somebody. And
with all due apologies to Danilo Perez.
I think he'd love to. I think you'd love to play the piano, but
I'd love to, but I don't think I'm going to learn to play piano now. But I do think that we can end up working, collaborating together at some point. That's for sure. Yeah. That's going
to
happen.
Well, just one last question to you, Ruben Blades. We understand you've just finished up a 5-year term as Minister of Tourism in Panama, your native country.
Yes.
We know how politically active you've been. You once formed a political party. You once ran for president in Panama. As a youngster, you witnessed political upheaval in your country. And you're now about to have a reunion with your group to mark the 25th anniversary of your landmark recording, Buscando America. Do we see you going back to politics, or are you off in a different direction with Luba now?
Well, right now, after 5 years of service to my country, I want to go back to music for a while. I need it. And I also would like to go back to film. And then at some point, returning to public service. I found it very rewarding. I'm less selfish. And I'm very proud of the fact that I spent my 5 years helping people and not just helping myself.
Well, perhaps in celebration of your upcoming reunion with your group, let's go out with Luba's song reunion from her new CD. The CD again, Crazy Love, Crazy with a K. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Luba Mason, Ruben Blades, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you so much, Ruben.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.